Chapter 49 The Dragon Slayers. The sudden and unexpected arrival of several tons of unconscious dragon in the centre of the battle had an interesting result. Everyone, human and Gavanni, ran like hell away from the dragon. That played havoc with the tactics of the situation. The goblin right was already falling to the charges of the cavalry, strengthened by the garrison from the castle. The left wasn't faring much better, but was still intact as a military unit. But the centre? The dragon had fallen through the south wall and rolled down the incline, smashing the gate, rolling over the moat like it wasn't there, smack into the goblin rear, which was already under assault from the garrison infantry. Neither party fared well. In the aftermath, we learned over 700 brave Gilmoran men-at-arms had been crushed in the dragon's fall. And every time its tail jerked, another dozen on either side were in peril. The sprawling wing swept over the beleaguered left line, dashing it to splinters. But it didn't come steadily to rest. The beast was spasming, and every mighty tremor was an assault on its surroundings. That convinced everyone that getting out of the way was more important than staying to fight the battle. Man and Gervan alike fled the field at top speed, seeking any safe place against the gargantuan tremors.
"Are you sure it isn't dead?"
Tyndall asked, hopefully, as we started down the ruined causeway toward the dragon and the battle.
"It looks dead.
It's still breathing," I pointed out. "It's hard to tell under all of that armor, but you can see its torso rise and fall. Ragged, but it's still breathing."
"How did you manage the lightning, Master?"
he asked in an undertone.
"That was bloody brilliant."
"Thank Pentandra," I dismissed. "But it didn't do as much as I'd hoped. It did give me an idea, though. I used my snowstone pendant as a means of lowering the local resistance field, which let her hook the worm to her spell. It wasn't a lot, but it was enough."
"Do you think the pendant survived that?"
he asked, as he gestured to the devastation before us.
"Probably not," I admitted, "but if you recall, that's hardly the only piece of snowstone on the field today."
Tyndall's eyes got wide and he almost stopped, blocking the narrow path left of the ruined causeway and earning a dirty look or two from the determined war magi behind him.
"So start contacting everyone you can down in the battle and relay these orders. Every man with a piece of snowstone should do his best to get it in proximity to the dragon."
"That might be difficult to accomplish," Planner said from behind me. "Most of our men seem to be running away from the dragon."
"Still, that's how we can do this," I reasoned, "and we had better do it quickly, because if that thing wakes up before we dispatch it, we probably won't get another opportunity."
The word spread quickly, thanks to the facility of mind-to-mind communication, and within moments I could see men from all over the field hurling little white pebbles against the bulk of the dragon.
"Penny, does that help matters?"
I asked, as I neared the bottom, where the gatehouse that had withstood a week of goblin assault had been reduced to a crater by the falling dragon.
"Yes. Oh, dear gods, yes,"
she agreed happily. "I think we'll be able to get something working on it soon.
Dara is ready with the thoughtful knife. She's been practicing,"
she added a little hesitantly.
"Practicing?
On goblins. We got an urgent message from Sir Ansel, leading the left flank, who needed support. Dara used the knife. Min, it was highly effective,"
she said simply. Penny is unused to the horrors of war, despite being in a few battles by now. From all accounts, the thoughtful knife was hell on infantry, being able to slice through armor like cloth and flesh like butter. I thought of the massed goblinry on the left, and how a fast-flying blade might fare among them.
"I hope she wasn't too upset," I said cautiously.
"She'll survive. She doesn't like goblins."
"She's in good company. Have her try a run at the dragon while it's still stationary. And Penny, if that thing wakes up, don't wait for the order. Run, get your people out of there and withdraw."
"Mind, I..."
"That's an order, Penny. That thing almost wiped me out with a flick of its tail and it killed my horse. If it wakes up, it won't wake up pretty, so get the hell out and let us deal with it. You've done enough, more than enough, today."
"Oh, shut up, Min. I'm not going anywhere. Besides, if you die, they'll expect me to run everything, and I don't want that job."
"Penny, you run everything already," I pointed out as I drew twilight. There was a group of goblins clustered just past the ruined guardhouse, either deserters or survivors or reserves. They weren't looking particularly threatening, but then I wasn't feeling particularly merciful.
Yes, but I'm not responsible for it. You are. I want the power. I don't want the blame.
Good to know that, I replied. Now get busy with whatever creative nastiness you can think of that might affect that mountain disguised as a lizard before the Gavanni get regrouped. The skirmish at the bottom of the causeway was brief and brutal. The Gavanni weren't expecting such a powerful attack from within the wreckage of a burning castle. The first six of us that made it to the bottom slaughtered 20 Gavanni in a burst of frustrated enchantment. Jindaran the Trusty was particularly effective, using an invisible field to stun the goblins before using a freezing spell to clog their throats with ice. But after that exercise, the dragon's massive butt lay before us on the cobbled plaza, the tail still twitching dangerously. I could see hundreds of white pebbles around it already, and I tried to hook a simple spell to it. It was still very resistant, but in the end I could push through. Everyone, I ordered, as the other war magi began to collect around me. I want binding spells on this thing. I want it asleep. I want it dead. Whatever you can think of, now is the time to try.
It's still breathing,
Rondol said incredulously as he joined Tyndall and I. Taran and Mavone were right behind him.
What can take the full force of a lightning bolt and survive?
A dragon, Tyndall pointed out condescendingly.
Obviously.
The snowstone is helpful, Mavone noted, but it isn't ideal. Not unless we want to try to dissect it from the arse end to try to kill it.
I don't recommend that, he added helpfully.
The problem was that the head was on the other side of the remnants of the goblin left flank, which was on our right, now that we were approaching the battle from the other side, who were still reeling from the thoughtful knife attack, and suddenly very aware that the unconscious head of a very large, fire-breathing dragon was pointed in their direction. Of course, that was also keeping the Bovali attacking them at bay, but I doubt that was much solace. One sleepy belch, and they were in the fire. But that also kept the number of snowstones near the head light, and the head was still the most vulnerable part of the dragon. I ordered my war magi into some semblance of a formation, and we quick marched back around the goblin left until we were almost near the oak tree by which we'd begun our attack. That's when a sudden kick by the beast dug a 9-foot furrow into the cobbles of the plaza, and a half dozen infantrymen trying to get their stones close enough. The rain chose that moment to start coming down in sheets.
We need to get some stones right in its face,
Taran shouted over the wail.
If we can do that, we can get something lethal inside.
And how do you propose to do that? Mavone asked.
Sarakim managed to get an arrow into it, he pointed out. What if you could sneak a stone inside it?
Mavone chuckled, despite himself.
That would be an amusing foray, he admitted. By all means, good luck to you.
Before Taran could respond, the thoughtful knife zipped by so fast it was a blur. We all stopped speaking to watch the deadly magical bird dive into the mass of Gavanni and effortlessly use its delta wings to slice limb from limb. It made a bloody spiral through the goblins closest to the dragon, then, for good measure, tried repeatedly to plunge into the allegedly thinner skin near its throat, and while it did penetrate as much as 6 inches, that did little more than cut the dragon superficially. Again and again, Dara retreated the knife and tried again. It was impressively effective in slicing through goblins, but even at its thinnest, the dragon hide was just too resilient for even its enchanted edge.
So much for our secret weapon, sighed Mavone.
There are limits to the enchantments of even the Alka-Allon, agreed Taran.
Pity.
Bah, they gave us antique ties, Mavone said, shaking his head. Lovely ties, but hardly their finest weaponry.
Better than we can fashion, Tyndall pointed out boldly.
Master, could we stick that thing's head in the moat and drown it?
An intriguing idea, Mavone said after consideration, but impractical. The moat isn't deep enough, and somehow I think it would take a lot more water than that to fill its lungs to capacity.
We were still debating as we were joined by another group of war magi, Telemann, the Knight Commander, and a score of his Hawkins.
He looked tired and hard-pressed in his battered black armour, but Telamon has the regal bearing of a king and the iron will of a seasoned officer. The fact that he's a brilliant war mage is just secondary. He was helmetless, but he bore his mage blade and a broad, plain black round shield.
"We need to open its mouth," he said without preamble. "It's got to be tender in there, less armoured, at any rate."
"The last thing I want to see is that mouth open," Romdahl assured him.
"No, an apprentice shouldn't be that cheeky with a master, but discipline wasn't really our concern right then.
Perhaps, but it will be our best chance, unless you wish to volunteer to carve your way into its brainstem through its eyes while it sleeps," he offered.
That idea made Rondel go pale and shut up. We headed off across the battlefield, avoiding any pitched battles. That many war magi, that many high magi, all in one place, was a heady power to wield. Once we pushed back against the remaining Gervanni and tried to force them away from their position near the mighty snout, we were able to get within 50 feet of it. Sarakim had been busily retooling a few of his arrows as we marched, using simple binding spells to attach whatever slivers of snowstone he could get from his comrades to their shafts. I shouldn't have been surprised, but several seemed to have a lot more snowstone than the single pebble I'd instructed everyone to carry. By the time we were ready to assault the dragon's head, he had half a dozen ready to go. None were as large as my snowflake pendant had been, but they didn't need to be.
"Put them all along its upper lip," Telamon requested of the Merwini mage.
I thought the pouring rain would slow him down, but he had taken to that shiny alcan bow like it was part of his arm. It took him 30 seconds to affix 6 shafts in a crude moustache across the dragon's face. Each arrow burrowed into the armour until the snowstone on its shaft was pressed up against the hide.
"Will that do, Mage Lord?" he asked. "I hope it does, for I am out of shafts."
"That should be sufficient," Telamon said, a quiet smile on his face. He called a couple of his stronger men to help, and soon they were casting a spell that was forcing the mighty maw open like a hideous cavern.
"So which one of us is going in there?"
Mavone asked doubtfully.
"None of us," I said. "Penny, have Dara land the knife near me, please."
A moment later the triangular shape fluttered by, then came to a stop at my feet. Taking a spare snowstone from Sarakim, I affixed it as best I could to the back of the knife, right in the spot where the control stone sat when it was quiescent. Then I patted it.
"All right. Have her get this thing into its mouth and down its throat. Slowly. Try not to wake it up. When it's halfway down, let me know."
The knife went aloft a moment later, floating at waist level before turning and speeding toward the unconscious worm.
"I have a binding spell on it," Taran said excitedly. "A strong one, but there's something..."
Finished with the knife, I turned my attention to scrying. It took a moment to get some resolution and understanding of the chaos I was detecting, but it became apparent soon enough that someone was nearby, working to counter us.
"Shit! Shamans!" I swore. 2 or 3 of them, on the other side of the thing's head.
"They could just be defensive," Mavone pointed out.
"They're trying to wake that thing up,"
Taran contradicted excitedly, "and we just made it significantly less resistant to magic, even theirs. Min, hurry that knife up, quick!" There was a cluster of magic, Gavani magic, which I was primed to detect, nearby, and while the precise nature of the spells they were casting was unknown, you can get a good general feel for such things if you study them. These shamans weren't trying to scry. They weren't hanging defensive spells. They weren't even attacking. Taran was right. They were trying to wake the unconscious dragon. The knife approached the lips and dove into the foot-wide space between the menacing 3 rows of teeth.
"I've got to keep an eye on Dara and the knife. Mavone, you, Sarakim, Rondal, and Tyndall, go deal with those shamans. Take a few extra men if you need to. Everyone else, focus on maintaining the binding spells, wherever you can."
As they huddled up to prepare their assault, I gathered my team for holding it in place. As an example, I drew upon the magnificent power of my sphere and cast one of the most powerful holding spells I've ever cast. I could feel it hook into the beast's head only lightly, but it did take. So did several others I could feel around me.
That proved instrumental only a few moments later, when, just before Telemann and Mavone led the attack on the shamans, their spell worked. The dragon started to wake up. The first sign we had of this was watching a huge, fluttering eyelid, followed by an excited gasp from the beast as it struggled into consciousness. That gasp was potent, even if it wasn't a flame. Dragon breath smells strongly of methane, like a barracks privy after a busy night of leave.
"Tear gods!" I heard Planner's moan behind me. The stench was overpowering.
"Probably exhausted stomach gases," Taran said thoughtfully, "ignited in the mouth by some alchemical mechanism or simple enchantment. What I would give to study the beast. I'll let you take it home when we're done with it," I quipped.
"Penny, is Dara in place?" I added, mind to mind. "That thing is waking up."
"She's just about there," Pentandra responded after a moment. "Things got difficult a moment ago," she says. "It's harder to maintain the connection once it went inside. The resistance. But the snowstone is helping," she added. "I've got a hook on the knife myself."
"Tell her to start cutting," I said, anxious about the outcome. The dragon's head was still magically bound to the soil, but that didn't bind the rest of his body. "The sooner we can incapacitate it, the better."
It took only seconds to see the effect of Dara's attack from within. The dragon's eyes opened wide in shock and pain, and quite to both armies' discomfort, it began to panic. Waking up from unconsciousness with a biting pain in your throat and suddenly unable to move your head will make any creature panic. But when this beast allowed fear to rule it, the scrambling it did in an attempt to try to free its head destroyed squadrons of soldiers and scores of Gavanni under its bulk. But we had the head, if only barely. With every passing moment, the dragon's alarm grew as the pain in its throat worsened and its panic deepened. Its long neck became more and more stretched as it dug in with its gargantuan hind feet and tried to pull itself free. I could see the slight bulge at the base of its neck where it was having the most difficulty, where the knife was playing havoc from within. It wasn't killing the dragon, though. Oh, it was hurting it, even wounding it, but it wasn't slaying it, not quickly enough by far. Indeed, the strain on our combined binding spells was tremendous, and a few times I felt my own stretched to the breaking point by the resistant beast.
"We need a bigger knife," bemoaned Sarakim.
"Or an axe the size of a barn door," I agreed.
"We could try to bind its feet and wings too," Jendaran suggested.
"Somehow I don't think we're going to have time for that," I pointed out. "We need to put an end to this now. Everyone who isn't holding their binding spell right now needs to attack that area. If we hit it from outside, and the knife is carving from within, between the two we should be able to decapitate the thing." And we tried. For almost 10 minutes we lobbed whatever spells we could to try to help the knife break free. But dragons are apparently almost as tough on the inside as they are on the outside. Dara was doing damage, but it was slow going, even for an enchanted flying blade. I tried a couple of the more powerful and damaging spells I knew, but they barely scratched the hide, much less hurt it seriously.
"Tara's nearly stuck," Penny reported to me a few moments later. "She's still making progress, but there's a lot of, well, blood and such in the way, and the twisting and turning aren't helping her control much."
I thought furiously while the others gave it a turn, and the dragon began to shake the fuzziness of unconsciousness from its trapped head. Snowstone was the key. It had to be. Somehow, the power of a magic spell had to be concentrated in close proximity to a piece of snowstone a sufficient size in order to deliver the kind of damage necessary. I watched as one magi after another took a crack at the region. Despite their best attempts, the dragon's first priority and focus of attention was still its immobilized head, not the tickle in its throat. Then it hit me. I had precisely the tool I needed. More specifically, I had precisely the man I needed. I turned to Taran and Sarakim. "Go find me Sire Kay of Sevendor," I ordered, "wherever he is on the field, and pray he isn't dead, or we might all be joining him." Sarakim found him. Of course, Sire Kay was on the far, far side of the battle, helping Baron Arathaniel and his gentlemen patrol the field, pick off fleeing stragglers, and occasionally make a foray against the remnants of the goblin right flank.
But Sayake was hale and well, and dutifully followed the archer when he gave him my orders. It took even longer to re-thread their way around the periphery of the battle to get back to our post, and by that time the dragon was good and mad. "What can I do for you, Mage Lord?" he asked, saluting. His pretty armor was dented and scratched in 100 places, splashed with goblin blood and mats of black hair. But Sayake himself had taken only a few injuries, and he still had his lance and his sword. Indeed, he bore one of the 3 fine war lances I had given him on the day of his tournament victory, and a snowstone pendant similar to mine. "Give me your snowflake," I directed him, "then get a big drink of water and prepare yourself for the biggest joust of your life." "Mage Lord?" he questioned. I took the snowstone from him and examined it. Rondol had done a decent job with the sculpting and had left a hole I could stick my pinky finger through in the center. I focused and worked an enchantment, and soon the hole was growing to twice its size. When it was of sufficient size, I slid it down over the deadly steel point of the lance until the sloping angle of the shaft of the lance held it tight. It was only 4 inches behind the head. I hoped that would prove sufficient. "It's your lucky day, Sayake," I muttered while I worked. "Your special talent with the lance is going to be used to great effect today." "But you seem to have the left well under control," he said, nodding toward the steadily shrinking troop of Gavanni. "There couldn't have been more than 1,500 of them left at this point." "Not against the goblins," I explained, as I spelled the snowflake to adhere to the lance, then returned it to his hand. "Against the dragon." He looked pale. He didn't nod. He just stared at me. "If there was another way, I'd do it," I promised, apologetically. "If this is what my lord requires of me," he said quietly. I could appreciate why he seemed so grave. "If someone asked you to single-handedly charge a dragon that outweighed you by several 100 tons, armed only with a sharp stick and a snowflake, you might see it as more suicide than challenge yourself." I felt awful about it, thinking about Lady Estret and Sire Kay's new stepdaughter, waiting back home in Sevendor for his return. But I looked at the panicking dragon, looked at our scattered forces, looked at the ruined castle, and then I realized that thousands of men would be leaving widows and orphans behind today. There would be thousands more if this dragon was not subdued. If Sire Kay could triumph, even at the cost of his own life, then their sacrifice would not have been in vain. I paused to add a few more enchantments I thought would be helpful, then passed the weapon back to my castellan. Sayake was grim as he accepted the lance. Grim, but the man knew his duty, as the set of his jaw indicated. The first duty of any knight is always to die gloriously in battle. Dying while attempting to slay a dragon all by yourself had to be as close to a divine visitation as a knight could ask for. "By all the gods it shall be done, Mage Lord," he agreed, after I explained to him what I wanted him to do. "If I don't, you can trust me to take care of them," I promised, without hearing his inevitable question. "Whatever happens, you have my word." That mollified him, and he looked slightly more at peace when he remounted his destrier. "Then it shall be done," he repeated loudly. "I'll walk with you until you're in place," I said quietly, "but we must hurry. I don't know how much longer we can keep it bound." We said little as we came to an empty space in the field that allowed unimpeded access to the dragon's ensorcelled head. I handed him his helm, tightened his saddle strap and stirrup straps for him, and held a water bottle to his lips before he nodded that he was ready. I drew Twilight and gave him as formal a salute as I could. "Sevendor!" the big mountain knight bellowed as he dug in his spurs. His big brown stallion reared dramatically and then dashed forward, bearing Sayake's armored weight on its back like he was a child. We all watched in fascination as the lone knight's steed raced across the 100 yards to the bulging neck. All of the magi could feel the magical wave building almost immediately, and by the time he was within 20 yards, you could see it without mage sight, a kind of fuzzy distortion effect around his body. He lowered his helm and couched his lance, his aim steady and true. The second it touched the dragon's neck, the wave collapsed and transformed. Thanks to the nearness of the snowstone, there was little to impede it,
and the resulting crack and flash was far in excess of what I expected. Sayake and his steed were enveloped in a powerful cloud of smoke, steam, dust, blood and gas, and disappeared from view for a moment. Only when the cleansing rain had intervened did we see if our brave knight had been victorious. We saw the damage to the dragon's throat before we saw anything else. Sayake's run had been successful. Between the pressure from within from the knife and the sudden stabbing explosion of Sayake's lance, even the dragon's tough skin couldn't absorb all that energy without succumbing to damage. The neck was torn half asunder from the body, a great charred hole smoking in the rain. We found Sayake 20 feet away, unconscious and bruised, but without apparent serious injury. His horse was not so lucky. I was sympathetic, after losing Traveller, but we could always get him another horse. I was just relieved that I didn't have to inform Lady Estret that she was a widowed bride for the second time. I just hoped he woke up from his unconsciousness before we made it back to Sevendor. The knife cut itself free from the wreckage of the dragon's neck and sped back to its operator, a shining streak across the dark and gloomy field. The goblins who witnessed the fall of their dangerous ally were filled with dismay and began to quit the field almost at once. Telamon's attack on the three remaining shamans had helped turn the tide too, as they had been attempting to rally their army and summon reinforcements. Telamon and Mavone had dueled two of them before managing to slay them, and even though one escaped, with a handful of snowstone, from what Mavone saw, the dramatic death of the others to the hands of the hated war magi had been dramatic enough to cow the survivors. For the most part, they threw down their weapons and fled. The rest of the evening was spent cleaning out the last bits of goblin resistance, chasing them into the wild, and caring for the wounded. That was particularly difficult, as there were hundreds of men crushed or burned from the dragon's fall. I pressed most of the civilian magi into service as field medics, and was joined by a company of clerics from the local region. Near midnight, the reinforcements from Barrow Bell finally arrived, 1,000 fresh troops who were willing to stand guard throughout the remainder of the night, while the rest of us collapsed in exhaustion wherever we could. I pulled rank, and had Rondal secure the use of an abandoned and partially destroyed peasant hut in the castle's village, where I walked right past the food and wine my thoughtful apprentice had laid out for me. Instead, I collapsed next to Penny, who had wrapped up in her cloak on the dry dirt floor. It felt as if it was the finest featherbed. I didn't feel guilty about sleeping one bit, even though I had a million things to see to. I had helped slay a dragon. I deserved a nap. I was tired. The next morning dawned cloudy, but without the rain that had made the previous day's battle so inconvenient. After checking with the medics about Sayake's condition, unchanged, still unconscious, as well as a few dozen others I knew who had been hurt, we began to assemble the butcher's bill. That was difficult to assess, in part because there was still a mammoth corpse of a dragon laying on top of possibly scores of men. As it was, the bill was high. Of Telamon's 6,000 men, less than 4 remained, mostly horse. His infantry had borne the brunt of the dragon's flailing, but he still had enough to garrison a castle. Of course, the castle wasn't fit to be garrisoned anymore. The tower had collapsed across the road, destroying a few village huts along the way, and the wall was shattered in 2 separate areas. The bailey was pockmarked with rubble and gouges from the dragon's talons, and the keep, more than half of the citadel, was crumbled. What was left wasn't defensible in any meaningful sense. "It won't matter," Talamon confided in me, as we assessed the damage. The importance of this castle was strategic, not defensive. It lay along the road through Gilmora. There's a somewhat smaller castle 20 miles north of here, and a larger but just as poorly constructed castle 6 miles southwest of here. Those are my alternate commands. Move north, I advised. Every time we take a step back and lose ground, it's a problem. Until we get adequate reinforcements, every foot of ground we retake in Gilmora is a victory, and you can always fall back to your alternate if you need to. Much harder going forward. That's sound. Mavone nodded. There's enough cavalry here to patrol and to screen an infantry force along the way.
They've done an admirable job cleaning up last night, he added. They had, too. Led by Baron Arathaniel and some local commanders, companies of 100 or so lancers hunted goblins by night. There had been enough war magi with them to make it useful. Magic is great for seeing in the dark, the Gervan's greatest ally. Thankfully, few bands had the courage or numbers to stand and fight, and most were willing to run back north as soon as they saw the glint of steel. That still left thousands and thousands of goblins roaming the countryside. Gilmore is a large place, 5 baronies and then some, and most of it was fighting for its life right now. The magnificent old manors and beautiful cities of the prosperous region were in flames. Its people were refugees or stubborn defenders, and its legendary fecundity was at a standstill, as crops rotted unharvested in the fields, or were trampled under the iron sandals the goblins were beginning to wear. There were a dozen small castles under siege in this barony alone, and scores of villages had been attacked, abandoned, or razed. We were doing no more than providing an aggressive defense of Barrowbell. The invasion of Gilmore was still appallingly underway.
The good news is, we slew a dragon,
Talaman reminded us, and just when we needed to. We proved that they aren't invulnerable. We also proved that they are extremely difficult to kill. It took the combined might of most of the Horkans and a good number of Hessians and volunteers to bring it down, and the help of the Alka'alon. We learned a lot from the experience, Taran pointed out helpfully. I can't wait to get that thing back to the lab to study it, he said, indicating the massive corpse of the worm.
Enjoy, Mavone said, bowing. I'd prefer to study a brothel and a wine cellar myself.
How many high magi did we lose? I asked. It was the question I really didn't want to ask.
8, sighed Turleman. 9 if Asti doesn't pull through. And 4 of your volunteers, he added. They got caught by one of those silly dog-cart chariots and were slain with arrows. On the brighter side, we recovered 4 additional stones, he added.
4 stones, 8 high magi, 4 spellmongers, 900 infantry, 600 cavalry, I listed.
780 cavalry, corrected Baron Arathaniel, joining us with Sir Ronsil and a few other knights, and expect that number to grow. Some of those goblins were using poisoned blades. Wounds thought minor are festering within hours. The Herb brothers are asking your magi for help with the malady, but it appears to be insidious.
The Baron looked tired, but pleased with himself, his armor hacked and battered, until it resembled a pot too often patched, his regal-looking tabard in tatters.
But by doing sweaty sack, Mage Lord, that was a fight I'll remember until the day I die.
I looked up at the dead dragon, its blood draining into huge puddles that were mixing with the puddles of rain on the broken plaza.
Baron, if there's a man here who can forget that battle, I want to meet him. Then I want to be him.